Welcome to the D Word, the UK's only weekly internet radio show that talks dementia, with me, your host, Peter Hill. Good to have you company here on the D Word. Now, we've had many first-time authors on the show, and each has brought a unique perspective based on their experience. And this week's guest, Miles Bingham, is no exception. His book, Dead Aheaded, was compiled by using his thoughts alongside his late mother Valerie's journal, taking readers on a journey which started with his father developing symptoms of dementia. Miles will be joining me right after this from Hal Ketchum.
Everybody's broke, Bobby's got a buck. Put a dollar's worth of gas in his pickup truck. We're going 90 miles an hour down a dead end road. What's a hurry, son? Where you gonna go? We're gonna howl at the moon, shoot out the light. It's a small town Saturday night. It's a small town Saturday night. She's got a lipstick on a little too bright. Bobby's getting drunk and looking for a fight. Liquor on his breath, trouble on his mind. Well, Lucy's just a kid along for the ride. Got a six-pack of beer and a bottle of wine. Gotta be bad just to have a good time. They're gonna howl at the moon, shoot out the light. It's a small town Saturday night. It's a small town Saturday night. Bobby told Lucy the world ain't round. Drops off sharp at the edge of town. Lucy, you know the world must be flat. Cause when people leave town, they never come back. They go 90 miles an hour to the city limit sign. Put the pedal to the metal before they change their mind. They howl at the moon, shoot out the light. It's a small town Saturday night. They howl at the moon, shoot out the light. It's a small town Saturday night. It's a small town Saturday night. It's a small town Saturday night.
Hal Ketchum, who we sadly lost to dementia almost 6 years ago now, and Small Town Saturday Night. My guest on the D-Work this week is Miles Bingham. Miles, it's great to welcome you as my guest here on the D Word. Wanted to talk about the book, Dead Aheaded, which comes from a really interesting perspective as far as I'm concerned. You know, a lot of people have written books on the show, but I want to back on something actually. It's on your website. It says a deeply human dementia memoir that captures the heartbreak and absurdity of dementia care from multiple angles. And it's that real last two words that interest me, and the fact that it is from multiple angles.
Yes. Yeah, so my mother first wrote a book over a decade ago. And that was all about her caring for my father and his 30-year journey with Alzheimer's. And I was very pleased that she had that book published, but I never read it. And I didn't read it because it coincided with the death of my father. And I just simply didn't want to be sort of dragged back through the last 30 years. So I avoided the book at the time, and then it just became easier never to read it. And then many years later, my mother died of the same terrible disease. And when I was clearing out the house, I bought back all their writing material and books, etc. And then I plucked up the courage to read the book for the first time. And of course, it just took me back to, all those years of my dad's slow decline. And of course, then when my mother stopped writing, her own decline started in a sort of very cruel symmetry. So it triggered me into wanting to write not only my mother's story to add completeness, but also to interact with all the things that she'd previously written. And so the output in the book Deadheaded is effectively a dual narrative memoir where my mother talks about an event and then I talk about the same event. So you're seeing everything from two perspectives, both from the hands-on carer, my mother doing the day-to-day nitty-gritty stuff, and then my perspective as the hard-working professional son who's really never quite in the right place at the right time, and therefore sort of feeling guilty about being quite a sort of poor son and not supportive. So I think it brings something new to the party, which is these two perspectives. And really, Pete, it shows you that Alzheimer's really just sort of rips through not only the life of the person who's ill, but also the carers and the immediate family as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because a lot of people just concentrate on the condition and the person living with the condition, whereas you've kind of hit upon the fact it's a whole team. Everybody's affected. And it's interesting with your perspective because you're part of what's becoming known as the sandwich generation, or you were part of the sandwich generation. And I don't think there's enough written about perspective from that side of things.
Yes. I remember I lived on a good day about 4 hours' drive from my parents. So, I remember a particular story where I take my 3-year-old daughter up, and a 4-hour journey turns into five plus because you've got multiple toilet stops along the way for a small child. I get all the way to where my parents lived in the West Midlands, and my mother's only able to cope with a 3-year-old for about 10 minutes before she starts to get grumpy and disappears. And what should be a sort of lovely time with grandchild and grandmother quickly becomes a situation where I'm then looking for things to entertain my daughter. So I'm back in the car an hour later, trying to drive a further hour just to go to a soft play or a swimming pool, just to keep my child entertained. And you just feel yourself being ripped in different directions because you're trying to do what's right for your own child, but you're also then trying to be respectful to your parents as well. And it's an impossible balancing act.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one thing about the book is that I think firstly, it welcomes people into your family. And also, the first few chapters, I mean, this may sound really strange, but I read the first three chapters and I thought, well, the pieces of the jigsaw are coming together here. And it's almost like a detective novel that you're trying to put these pieces together. And also, you're getting the perspective of you and your mother are also trying to put those pieces together.
Yes, I mean, my father suffered for 30 years. So I remember, I was probably about 15, and I remember I used to play chess with my dad regularly. And then one day, for the very first time, I beat him, and then he refused to play chess ever again. And it was just the signal that something was wrong. And slowly, piece by piece, you get to understand that your dad's not quite right. But the thing about dementia and Alzheimer's is it's so slow, it just chips away at the individual. And you quickly get used to this new version of your father. But then 6 months later, there's another turn of the dial and they're slightly different again and slightly different again. And this went on for years. And my mother struggled to get a diagnosis for my father simply because the medical profession at the time wouldn't deal with my mother or myself. They would only talk to my father if he came of his own volition to go to the doctors. So in the end, the doctor says to my mother, Well, I can only intervene if your husband starts to hurt you or harm you, and then we can step in. But then, other than that, I can't really talk about your husband because of patient confidentiality, which just seems like a ridiculous situation. So he was declining for a 10-year period before he got put on drugs for the very first time, and then, another 20 years of slow decline.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So damn long, I've been looking for you, baby, like the words to a song I've been trying to write every night, but I just can't get it right. And I kept your faded baby blue bandana. Oh, Savannah. Oh, Savannah, yeah, you're missing me. Well, I'll be waiting for you underneath the live oak tree with a tear in my eye and a guitar on my knee. I got a Cherokee rose that I want to hand you. Oh, Savannah. Oh, Savannah. I wish that you were mine. Oh. Counting every star inside. I wish I might have this wish I wish tonight, that you could finally see what you mean to me. Oh, Savannah. Oh, Savannah. You've been on my mind. Oh,
oh.
49 Winchester and O Savannah here on UK Health Radio, where you can find all our shows available to listen again and download on the website ukhealthradio.com. I'm chatting to author Miles Bingham about his book, Deadheaded. I think there's one thing, you know, later on in the book, there's one sentence that really resonated with me and with all the people that I speak to on the show. And it's a fairly simple sentence. It says, if only someone had explained things from the start. And,
yes.
And that, you know, well, you're saying with the GP or whatever, everything your mother went through with all the bureaucracy and all that stuff. And it still seems that it is lacking, that people don't get explained all these things from the beginning.
No, I think I'd like to think it's better today, but it probably isn't. But back in my parents' period, you know, you've got a memory clinic just wanting to do the memory tests. You've got social services dealing with some aspects. You've got a GP dealing with some aspects. And then you've got hospital visits as well. And that's just all around Alzheimer's. But then there's all the other health conditions that typically go on with people of that age group. And it's all completely disconnected. There's no single person that looks at you as a case or takes an overview. And, you know, indeed with my parents, it wasn't until my mother went into Age UK in their local town that somebody sat her down and said, do you realise you should be getting all these financial benefits? And, you know, they'd missed out for years because nobody knew, nobody explained. And I just don't understand why somebody can't sit down when you first get that diagnosis and say, here's the 100 things you have to do. Here's a tick sheet. But yeah, what my mother received at the time was basically a folder on geriatric care about how to keep my father, you know, fed and watered and warm, but almost nothing on Alzheimer's itself. So, you know, she just went through it sort of blind. And then when I ended up picking up my mother with her sort of late Alzheimer's, you know, you just muck through, don't you? But it could be so much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, other conditions, you can have a relatively clear path of where you start and where you're going. But for some reason, I spent a career in public health and never heard the D word mentioned for a start, which is part of the reason for this programme. But also, you know, Alzheimer's dementia is a disease, but it isn't treated in the same way as cancer, diabetes, etc., where there is a pathway.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I've heard this so many times on your show and elsewhere, and that's certainly the lived experience that we had. And it just makes it incredibly hard. So, you know, there are so many ways that the process could be improved, from diagnosis through to information, through to case handling. There are just so many things that could be done better than they currently are. And you know, given it's the UK's biggest killer now, how big does it need to get before people step forward and make those improvements?
Yeah, it's, you know, absolutely. And I think a lot of people are, you know, going slightly off track here, but point to the top of the tree in the fact that we still don't have a dementia strategy. So,
yes,
you know, there isn't anything that feeds down from the top that, you know, those people at the bottom can then start to take advantage of.
Yes, yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing that's interesting about the book and my parents' case is the fact that both of them donated their brains to medical research, which, of course, is an absolutely wonderful thing to do. But it's mildly traumatizing for their son, you know, having those sorts of conversations. And I think, you know, in my mind, donation was all about organ donation, healthy donation. You're giving life, you're passing on kidneys, lungs, livers, etc. And it's such a positive thing. And I don't think I appreciated that there was also donation in relation to brain donation. And I just love the way my mother sort of slipped it into the conversation one day on the telephone, just managing my expectations. Oh, you know, just to let you know, your dad's brain's going to be removed when he's dead. And, oh, and by the way, you know, I've donated my brain as well. And we've all added that into the will. And it's, you know, it's quite a dramatic situation.
Yeah, there certainly is. And also reading it, I don't want to preempt what's in the book. I want people to read it. But the report you get back after that also must have been quite dramatic, just looking at the
Yes.
descriptions and everything it says.
Yeah. So look, I've got, huge faith in all the people that do this sort of science and work. They're doing a fantastic job. Let's just be clear about that. But in our individual situation, this is a few years ago now, my mother actually received the full 12-page brain autopsy on her husband, my father. I'm not sure that should have been sent to us. And my mother takes one look at it and says, "Well, there's nothing they can tell me about my husband. I've been dealing with him for 30 years up till his death." So she just sends it to me. So I receive this 12-page autopsy report that, talks about the weight of the brain, how it's been sort of sliced, diced, and preserved. And even relatively squeamish people, I think, would find that rather odd. But as I say, I think it was sent in error. But it allows me to sort of lean into the absurdity of the situation. So whilst my mother, I think, has a sort of dry wit throughout the book, as a coping mechanism, as things are increasingly falling apart, I just lean into the absurdity of it all. So whilst having a book about two parents effectively dying of Alzheimer's sounds like a very sort of bleak subject matter. You have to tell me, Pete, what you think. But hopefully, the humour and the observed humour helps counterbalance that and makes it more of a good read rather than a read you just have to get through.
Yeah, I think it's, whenever I talk to authors, the first thing I say is it's got to be readable. So it doesn't matter what the subject matter is, to start with, you've got to entice a reader in, and you do that. There's no doubt about that. One of the other areas that came to mind when I was reading it was that when I was at the Alzheimer's Society, we used to have kind of sheets with about me on, or those kind of things that told a little bit of history behind the person. But I was thinking, your perspective, the way this book's written, it'd be brilliant if you had one of these for every person, because this is an about me. I've learned a lot about your dad, and it wasn't just about Alzheimer's, it was about him as a person, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, my parents were two very talented individuals in terms of drama and art and writing and all the things that you think should be protective of brain health. And then, ironically, both of them suffer from the same disease of Alzheimer's, which seems, particularly cruel and counterintuitive to people that should have a high level of cognitive reserve. And maybe the fact that my dad lasted 30 years is because he had that high level of cognitive reserve. He was a really smart chap when I was a child. So yeah, I want to tell my parents' story and make them, real characters and real people because, it makes the end situation of them both suffering and dying of Alzheimer's, I guess, that much harder and difficult for everybody, including myself.
I could be a millionaire if I had the money. I could own a mansion. No, I don't think I'd like that. But I might write a song that makes you laugh. Now that would be funny. And you could tell your friends in England you'd like that. But now I've chosen aeroplanes and boats to come between us. And a line or two on paper wouldn't go amiss. How is Worcestershire? Is it still the same between us? Do you still use television to send you fast asleep? Can you last another week? Does the cistern still leak? Or have you found a man to mend it? Oh, and by the way, how's your broken heart? Is that mended too? I miss you. I miss you. miss you. I really do. I've been reading Browning, Keats and William Wordsworth, and they all seem to be saying the same thing for me. Well, I like the words they use, and I like the way they use them, you know. Home Thoughts from Abroad is such a beautiful poem. And I know how Robert Browning must have felt, 'cause I'm feeling the same way about you. Wondering what you're doing, and if you need some help, do I still occupy your mind? Am I being so unkind? Do you find it very lonely? Or have you found someone to laugh with? Oh, and by the way, are you laughing now? 'Cause I'm not.
Song, Rumour and Clifford T. Ward's Home Thoughts from Abroad. Always good to hear from you on the show. We're on social media as Radio TDW and the email is tdwradio@gmail.com. And someone who did contact us is this week's guest, Miles Bingham. Your reaction when you finished it, what was your feeling when you finally finished the book?
That's really interesting. I mean, I learned so much from reading my mother's original work, because it's like opening up a time capsule, and there were things there that I just hadn't known at the time because I was so far away and so distant. Yeah, and to be fair, Pete, I don't think I try and portray myself as some fantastic son that drops everything to be there all the time. It's almost the opposite. I'm almost hiding behind work and using that as an excuse. So, I certainly went through a journey of understanding, you know, just how tough it must have been for my mother to do the day-to-day care. But, you know, things that jumped out at me were the fact that my dad was put on a drug called Aricept, which, when I Googled it, is still the number one drug being given out to people today. He was put on that nearly 30 years ago. And in my mind, I'm thinking that the medical treatment of Alzheimer's, isn't it like iPhones? Isn't there a sort of a new one coming out every year and a half? And surely there's new versions and new improvements. And I just found that terribly depressing that people are still being put on a drug that back in the day was described to my mother as, well, we're not really sure if this works or not. So I found that interesting. And then, you know, the other thing that was, I think, particularly disturbing was my mother trying to get my father into a care home and all the funding issues with the local authority, or in fact, two local authorities, because he ended up going over county lines to another county. And, you know, nobody asked me. If somebody had said to me, could you chip in £300 a month or £500 a month? I would have just said, yes, fine. I was a professional working person. And, you know, he could have been in a home straight away. But this just dragged on for so long that my mother described herself as broken through that process, you know, absolutely destroyed by the months spent trying to find a home. So I found all that, you know, disturbing and upsetting. Because I just hadn't appreciated it at the time. I think my parents were wartime children, and they were brought up just to just take everything on the chin, sort it out themselves, grin and bear it. And the last thing they wanted to do was ever pick up the phone and ask me for help or burden me. They just thought, Miles has got his own children, he's living his own life, and we can handle this ourselves. But of course, they can't, they couldn't, and I could have done so much more. But yeah, they never asked. But anyway, in answer to your original question, I wrote my words very quickly. They just flowed out of me. It was almost as if they were sort of trapped inside me. And then I felt a lot better once I'd put pen to paper because I'd captured my mother's story. And that now felt like the whole book was complete. So it wasn't just about my dad, it was about my mother as well. And of course, her Alzheimer's journey was completely different because she was never diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And when I was told that she died, I was told she died of an infectious disease. And it was only a year later that her brain autopsy report came through, not the full report, just a standard letter basically saying, just to let you know, she died of Alzheimer's as well. So that was something of a hammer blow because I hadn't been expecting that. In my mind, she died of sort of a COVID-like infection during that period. So all of a sudden, having one parent die of Alzheimer's is bad luck. Having two parents die of Alzheimer's, well, that's a huge red flag, isn't it? So then that brings me to that sort of introspective closure to the book where I'm now worried about my own brain health because, clearly in the genetic lottery, I'm probably not got the winning ticket. I'm going to be unlucky. So, I'm doing a lot now to try and maintain my own health. And try not to fall foul of what happened to my parents.
Yeah, it's interesting, what you say at the end, that now your family are just keeping a, maybe a closer eye on things, and is dad forgotten his car keys again or whatever, because of all this experience that everybody's gone through.
Yes, they watch me like hawks now, and then I'm self-conscious of that. So, every time I park the car, I'm trying to make an extra mental note as to where I've parked it. The thing is, I've always had a really poor memory myself, and I deal with that in the book. It's one of those ironic things. My first school report said Miles has got a brain like a sieve. And I'm mildly dyslexic, dyspraxic, etc. So I know I'm not quite wired right. So I now have this fear that when I'm dragged to the memory clinic and somebody puts me through my three-word memory recall test, I'm going to fail it because I already fail it. I can't do that. I just can't hold that information in my head. So I have this strange anxiety fear that I'm going to get sort of checked into a home for people with dementia at a young age simply because I can't pass those tests.
Yeah, I think you've opened up another door there, which we won't go into. But they are blunt instruments in terms of tests, and I guess when you look at the book, and you read what your father went through in the book, it wasn't all about drawing a clock face or remembering three words or whatever. There is a heck of a lot more to it than that. And I guess that's the concentration on the memory thing as well, because people, when they don't know a lot about dementia, they think, well, it's memory, that's it. But when you read your book and see what your father went through, and it's a whole host of things way outside of memory going on.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he lost his short-term memory and recall, and then he lost his, if you like, standard memory. So, he couldn't play chess because he wouldn't know how to move the pieces. But then all these bizarre sort of things from childhood, like songs that he might have heard when his mother was, looking after him as a toddler, that comes up, and you think, where do these things come from that are buried? And then there's a character called Charlie that my mother spoke about, and my mother swore blind. I've known my husband for 60 years. He's never mentioned anybody called Charlie, and now he's walking around, talking to Charlie in a care home, a pretend person. Who is Charlie? And then when one of the workers says, did he know a person called Charlie? She says, no, he never knew anybody called Charlie. And then she suddenly said, actually, I don't even know whether Charlie's a human or an animal. I've got no idea what's going on inside my husband's brain. So it's sort of tragic but comic all at the same time.
UK Health Radio. the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
You know, as we were saying a little bit earlier, that humour is very important in carrying the reader through the book. There's a couple of interesting bits I wanted to ask you about. I read this one thing that you said in there, and you say at one point, if your parents had had a daughter, then conversations might have taken a different turn.
Yes. Yeah, and I think I'm trying to capture the sort of social history of, you know, how things are and how things were. But definitely as a male and somebody with a successful career, they just wanted to see me, you know, fly the nest and do my own thing. And there was never any expectation from them that I would be around for them to care for them, and I just wonder how would that have been if there'd been a daughter involved, and what are the social expectations? And you know, I can't answer that question because, as I say in the book, you know, they had me, but they didn't have a daughter. But you know, I didn't feel that compulsion to, you know, quit my job and move two streets away. But the female listeners, the female carers, and there's an awful lot out there, you know, may have a different perspective on that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, actually. I think it's something I'd like to pursue a little bit later on the show. You've opened a good door there, Miles. But, you know, and also when you think of it culturally, you know, I talk to people all over the world, and that very much comes into things.
Yes.
Different cultures of guilt.
There's a section in the book, isn't there, where my mother's now quite poorly and I have to arrange home help for her, people to come round and help feed and clothe and change her, etc. And I was describing to the care worker that came round how I was really struggling to get my mother to take her tablets and eat food that I prepared. And she basically turns around and says, you know, walk out the room and just watch this. And within 10 minutes, you know, she's got, you know, egg and toast inside my mother, and my mother's taken all her pills. And she just said to me in the corridor, it's just an intergenerational thing. You know, she doesn't want to be cared for by her son. You know, this is the last thing she wants, is to see her son, you know, changing her clothes and dealing with all the nasty side. But she'll take it from, you know, female or third party carers. So, you know, that was quite revealing as well, as in terms of the sort of the social commentary.
Mm, yeah, it's, you know, quite a lesson. And in terms of that role of, you know, when your mother went into hospital, you were suddenly thrust into this role of dementia carer. And obviously then, you know, your perspective up until that point, as you said, had been of son looking a little bit from the outside. But,
yes,
you know, you were thrust right into the gold face when that happened.
Yes. So my mother had a not insignificant breast cancer diagnosis and had to be operated on. And, you know, my mother asked me quite rightly, you know, take some time off, come up and help me. But what she really meant was help me with dad, Whereas I'm going out there to try and take her to hospital, sit with her in a hospital bed, and take her home after the operation. She doesn't want me there. She wants me back at the house. And of course, it's only when I go into the house and then I see all the yellow stickets all over the walls with instructions and food laid out that I suddenly, the penny finally drops that I'm actually here for my father, not for my mother. And there's a, another wonderful sort of absurd story where, for the first time, I drive my father to the local hospital in their local town to go and visit my mother post-operation, except my mother's not there. I'd always known about their local hospital and just assumed that they'd be doing the operation there. And when I went into the hospital, they said, no, we haven't done a cancer operation here for a decade. So I said, well, where's my mother? And they looked in their computer and said, well, our computer isn't connected to the main NHS one. We can't actually tell you where your mother is. And then I turned to my demented father and said, well, you were there this morning with her when you dropped her off. Where is she? And he looked at me like, I should know. So, my mother has had a cancer operation in a hospital. I don't know where it is, and I don't know how to find her. It's ludicrous and funny, but that was the reality of the situation of trying to look after a man with Alzheimer's who couldn't tell you where his wife was.
And I think, a number of things come out of that. And I think it's important you tell those stories. I know, mention the word absurd and whatever, but the people that do that for a living, day in, day out, don't actually see from your, it's almost like you looking from outside of what your parents are going through. You're looking from outside the organisation going, well, isn't this a bit absurd? No one's told me why my mum's gone into hospital. And, the more that's written in books and the more people are told, someone might actually step back and say, well, yeah, actually, that is a bit stupid, isn't it?
Yes, well, there's plenty of points in the book where you think that's a bit stupid, isn't it? And that's, I think that's, a key theme throughout the book, isn't it? Is basically, and we've already talked about this, it's simply how hard it is to look after somebody with Alzheimer's when there's no roadmap, no plan, and nobody taking a holistic view as to their care. And yeah, the other thing I think that jumped out at me was my parents lived in a relatively rural situation in a small town with a hospital, but they were travelling 25 miles each way to go to hospital visits and memory tests, etc. So that's a 50-mile journey for people of a certain age who no longer have a car because the car's been taken away because you're dealing with Alzheimer's. So that only works with a whole series of volunteers giving up their time to drive them around. And I just can't think of anything more awful than spending your day going back and forth to hospital tests. But all this was going on largely when I was ignorant of what was going on. I mean, it was only when I got more hands-on and more involved later on with my mother's care that I just saw it for myself how difficult these things must be.
So, you've gone through all that. You've done the book, which hopefully will be successful. Is that the end of the story, or is this really primed you on to look at all these absurd things that don't work and think, well, actually, I still want to be involved here, and hopefully things will improve?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So certainly since I've written the book and that journey of going through writing the book, it's made me even more conscious of my own health and well-being. And I want to share some of that as well. So I'm going to be doing some work with a charity called Dementia Prevention UK, where we're going to be talking to people about the small things that they can do much earlier on to intervene and improve their health, because Pete, at the end of the day, there's still no cure for this thing. So, you've got to try and stop people getting it in the first place or delay the onset. So, whilst the science isn't perfect, we know that people have to deal with their metabolic health to effectively affect their brain health. So we want people to avoid type 2 diabetes. We want them to be, on top of their alcohol consumption, not smoke, etc. All these key things. In other words, if it's bad for your heart, it's bad for your brain. So I'm very happy to share with people how having two parents who have died of Alzheimer's has, you know, stimulated me to try and make the absolute most of my health. You know, somebody described it as, you know, you're the chief exec of your own body. So, you know, I'm the one that's making those decisions. So, you know, I'm working hard to try and stay fit and healthy and not go down the path that my parents went down.
Yeah, I think it's great, actually. I like that. Chief executive of your own health. I think there's a really good ring about it. I think your parents would both be very proud of, you know, what you're doing now and hoping to achieve. As far as the book goes, when and where, I think, are the questions. When's it out? Where can we get it?
So the book's just been published. It's available on Amazon. It's called Deadheaded by Valerie Bingham and Miles Bingham. And you can also find out more at my author website, which is www.deadheaded.co.uk, which has got more about the book, photographs, extracts, etc. So I'd recommend going there if you want to find out more about what's going on.
Yeah, I'd recommend it as well. And I would recommend the book. I don't know if it enjoys the word that you should have for a book about that subject, but, you know, if it is, then it is a very good read. And it also teaches you things just about human nature more than anything else, as well as the subject. So, you know, congratulations to you and, of course, on your mum for the bit she wrote in the book. So I think it's excellent.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you for those kind words.
Well, Miles, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Do keep in touch with us at the D Word. But for now, anyway, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Miles, and I wish him all the best with the book. Deadheaded is published by Rate Publishing and is available now from all major booksellers. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to Angela, my production assistant. Next week, my guest will be Martha Pusey, and we'll be talking about her project using co-produced storytelling to give people with dementia a voice in care plans. So until then, thanks for listening, and take care now.